in the wilderness.
We're going to talk today about books of the Bible that are very early in their appearance, and that would be the five books of the Bible that were given by Moses. And we're going to select of those five books, three of them. And those three will be the experiences of Israel in the wilderness. Now you see on the slide here the relative periods of time that were spent, or that were covered in each of these narratives of the five books of the Bible. And you see the first one is disproportionately large. Some of them are very small. Now, I'm fudging a little bit on that 2,513 years. That really takes you from Adam to the Exodus. But, you know, the book of Genesis really closes with the death of Joseph. And, you know, that was actually from the death of Joseph to the Exodus, which pictures the end of the age, 144 years. A little picture of the gospel age that develops the 144,000 class. And we're going to be talking today about the gospel age, because the wilderness experiences of Israel deal with, typically, the experiences that you and I and our forebears and forebrethren have experienced through the gospel age from the beginning until the end. Now, as is the case with many scriptures, even though you have a main theme, typically and symbolically of a certain area of scripture, sometimes the theme expands beyond that. We're going to see that today as well. It'll broach into the kingdom somewhat. But we're going to primarily look at just three books. The Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, because those are the three that record the experience in the wilderness. Now the Exodus, even at 1 year, is a little bit off as well, because there was a build-up to the Exodus, and so the book of Exodus takes you through the first year of their wilderness experiences, but it really starts even before the Exodus, you know, with the plagues, so it could be a little bit longer than that. Leviticus for 1 month, whoa, when we get there we'll have to explain that. And the book of Numbers, the remaining 39 years in the wilderness. So we're going to go to the book of Exodus, and Exodus, you know, I always like to keep in mind as much as possible, as many details about these books as I can. One service detail is, how many chapters do you have in the book of Exodus? And you know, it's a very easy way to remember that. There are 40 years in the wilderness that they're going to, you know, embark on, and it has 40 chapters. Now by comparison, you know, Genesis is going to be longer, and so just add a nice round number to that. Add 10 more, you got 50. So you already know how many chapters are in those two books. Those kind of things actually, you know, once you engage them in your mind, they tend to stick with you. So we're going to look in Exodus and see the experiences that start after the Exodus, when the Israelites are in the wilderness, after Pharaoh's experience of the Red Sea and he's obliterated, after all that, just the time from that time forward, when the wilderness wanderings proceed. Now the first experience we find was in Exodus 15:23, when they came to a place called Marah. Now you may know that Marah means bitter. And of course this was the experience where they went to get water and they found out it was bitter. I presume that means bitter with salt and brine. And so they had to cast a tree into the water to sweeten the waters. Now we're going to go through these a little bit quickly because we're going to itemize these experiences. But the point we want to make is this starts at the beginning of the gospel age. Because at the beginning of the gospel age, the teachings of the law were deadly. They were salt, briny. You couldn't have the refreshing life that you want. So to sweeten those waters, you have to cast in the tree. And when you think of a tree prophetically or wood in general, when it comes to redemption, think of the cross of Christ. And the cross of Christ is what takes the bitterness out of the law, because Jesus, when he, you know, why he had to end that on a cross? Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. That word tree in the Greek and wood are the same word, essentially. So the fact that he died on the cross to take the burden of the law away from the Jewish people, that's the first incident. Starts us off in the gospel age. They go next to Elam, that's in chapter 15:27, and there they find 12 wells and 70 palms. And I think already your minds are associating 12 apostles, 70 disciples, and these are the early leaders of the Christian age that show we're still starting off, as it were, through the gospel age. And then they get to the wilderness of sin. Now that wilderness of sin, well, they grumbled a little bit, you might think, well, they're sinning, but that's not the point. The wilderness of sin actually doesn't mean to estrange them here. It's the name of a god. In this case, it's the name of a well-known moon god in antiquity. And what this really tells us is that they're still early in the Gospel Age, and the first problem they're going to encounter in the Gospel Age is still the old remnants of the law. That was an early problem for the early Christians. At this point, they need something better. They need some teachings better than the law. They need something spiritual, and this is where God gives them the manna. Now, this manna is remarkable. I mean, it came on the very next day after God said it would, and you know, it ended on the very day they crossed the River Jordan, and for 40 years, except on the Sabbath, every day you could go out and expect to find food. Now, when they first got the manna, you know how it was described? It was described as like wafers baked with honey. Whoa, I could eat that for 40 years. Well, after a couple of days, you know, it can get a little bit old. And so later on in the book of Numbers, when they grumbled about it, they said, we don't want anything but this manna, and it tastes like fresh boil. Not quite the sweet refreshment that they had remembered. And I think that can be the way spiritual nourishment comes to us too. It's wonderful. It's delicious. It's exciting. And yet, anything can get old. And we might still recognize it as the influence of the Holy Spirit, the oil, but it's lost that savory, you know, sweetness to us. So we've got to keep that in mind. But it was a remarkable testimony. Next, they go to Rephidim. They need water, and that's where Moses strikes the rock. And that represents the fact that at the beginning of the Gospel Age, Jesus had to be struck. He had to be smitten in order for that rock to issue the waters of life for us as we have received them in the Gospel Age. And there's going to be another smiting of the rock later if we have time to get to that. But this is the beginning of the Gospel Age. And then the next chapter, we don't think about so much. Chapter 18 in Exodus, that's where Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, comes to visit. And Jethro sees that Moses is put upon. He's got too many responsibilities for one man to handle. And so he says, you really need help. And so in Exodus 18, verse 21, Jethro said, you need able men, such as fear God, men of truth, to help you govern this people. And I think perhaps that represents that at the beginning of the Gospel Age, Jesus, of course, is our master, our shepherd, our leader. He's up above. He's not incapable. But, you know, we need somebody to talk to. We need directors. We need fleshly people that we can, flesh and bone people, that is, spiritually minded, that can lead and direct and help us. And I think we need able men, such as fear God, such as men, our men of truth, to help direct and nourish the church. So all of this starts off with the Gospel Age. Now, we finally get to the famous approach to Mount Sinai. Now, we're going to spend a lot of time at Mount Sinai. That is, the narrative is going to spend a lot of time at Mount Sinai. And they arrive in the third month, and they arrive at presumably the very beginning of that month. Now, it doesn't tell you a day number in Exodus 19, but most assumptions are that when they arrived on the third month, that meant the first day of the month. And we're going to suggest, and we'll see this a few times in our study this evening, that a brand new month or a brand new year both refer in their own way to a brand new age in God's plan. And I think that age is the Gospel Age. Now, when that third month, you know, three is the number in Scripture for redemption. Do you remember that Jesus was 3 days in the tomb? You remember he was sold, his valuation was 30 pieces of silver. Remember, Mary anointed him for his death, and it was, remember how many pence? 300 pence. And when Pentecost came, 3,000 people were saved. But that number is not coincidental. That's the number of redemption. Perhaps because there's three parties involved. God, those to be redeemed, and then, of course, Jesus in between. Now, Moses goes up the mountain, and he's made a remarkable offer. God says to him, I have a proposition for you and for the nation of Israel. You're going to be a peculiar people above all peoples of the earth. And you're going to be a kingdom of priests. Now, they're going to have priests, and they'll look like the Aaronic priests. But the whole nation is going to be priests in the sense that they're going to represent God to other people. And you're going to be a holy nation. Now, have you ever heard those terms used somewhere else? You find it in 1 Peter 2:9. He says, you, Israel, spiritual Israel, You're a peculiar people. It doesn't mean odd. It means treasured, chosen, and special. And our English is bad for that. But it means special. And you're going to be a holy nation and a royal priesthood. 1 Peter 2:9. And that's our calling, brethren, during this present gospel age. Now, as you go forward in this account of Exodus 19, there is an opinion, I even heard it expressed by Brother Byron, I think. I was going to comment to him, but I didn't see him since. I think I heard him say something about Pentecost. I don't see Brother Byron here, but I think he said something about this Jewish concept that the law was given on Pentecost. Well, that is a Jewish concept. And it comes from this opinion. It comes from the opinion that they arrived at Mount Sinai on the first day of the third month. And then on the next day, God, he went up the mountain and God says, I have a proposition for you. And the third day, he came down and told the people, and they all said, yeah, all that the Lord has said, we will do. And so on the fourth day, Moses goes back up and reports to God the agreement of the people. So then God says, now be ready for the third day. So you're on day four. The second day would be day five, and the third day would be day six. Well, the sixth day of the third month, every year in the Jewish calendar, is the day of Pentecost. Now, I heard recently, Brother Wildblood in California, I've heard him twice recently in our neck of the woods, and he picked up on this point twice, two different discourses I noticed. I think it's a correct thought. And I think this is telling us, again, that we're at the beginning of the gospel age going forward. Now, you may think, wait, there's other lessons here I know. Yeah, that's fine. We'll get to those in a moment. Stay with our train of thought here for a moment. God spoke. Now, this is something I didn't always know. I didn't know that when Moses got the Ten Commandments from God, he actually heard them verbally, and all of the Israelites in the camp heard them verbally, out loud, from heaven. You know, I thought Moses went up, God told him, he came back down, and the people said, okay, that's fine. No, that's not the way it happened. Moses was not up, he was down, when suddenly the voice of God began to speak. Every Israelite in the camp heard the voice of God. It's not as though Moses came back and said, I've got these Ten Commandments. And the people said, he's probably trustworthy, but how do we double check this? You don't have to double check. Every Israelite heard every one of the Ten Commandments booming out of heaven. Now, a few verses on that. We won't read them, but just cite them for you. Well, there they are. There's some, if you could read that, you know. But those are the verses that make it very clear. And you see the last one is Hebrews 12:25. And Paul says, we're there at Mount Zion, the counterpart to Mount Sinai. And he says, refuse not him that is speaking from heaven. Do you know what Paul is saying? He says, we're spiritual Israel who is hearing the commandments of God, and we should not refuse him any more than the Israelites should have refused him at that time. And then there was the blood of sprinkling. And in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, verse 24, Paul says, we have received the blood of sprinkling. We are committed, we're obligated, and we're involved in this. And finally, 40 days later, do you remember that when Moses came down from the mountain with a fuller, you know, package of the law commandments, what he found? He found everybody in expectation and say, good, Moses is back. No, he found that they had lost their patience and they had made a golden calf. And he said, who is on the Lord's side? And the Levites came forward. And by the way, this redeemed the Levites, who otherwise had reason to be dismissed. But now, for this reason, they stood forward and they said, yes, we're on the Lord's side. So you go through the camp and you start killing the offenders. You know how many died on that day? When the letter was imposed, 3,000 men died. Now you come to Pentecost, and there's a large number of people that Peter preaches to. And now it's not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law that's invoked. You know how many people got life on that day? 3,000 in the book of Acts. The letter kills, the spirit gives life. And now he went up and was in the mountain for 40 days. And again, he comes back, and now his face is beaming with glory. And in 2 Corinthians 3:8 and 18, Paul makes a point of that. He cites that experience and how there was this radiant beaming of Moses' face. And he says, we now have the fulfillment of that in the ministration of the Spirit and our glorious ministry of the gospel. Now, I've got to stop there for a moment. And I've got to explain that there are other meanings to these pictures than only what we're suggesting here. We're focused on the gospel age, and that's why we're commenting on it from that point of view. But you may know that there's also a greater point of view with these two periods of 40 days. That the first period represents the Jewish age, a period of testing and development. And after that period, you come down to the end, and it turns out the Jewish people are not respectful and ready to go into the gospel as they should have been. So they lose their opportunities. He goes back to the mount for 40 days. That would represent the gospel age. He comes down with a beaming face of glory, and that represents Christ, head and body, ready to administer the terms of God's law to the world of mankind. Now, I think that's a very beautiful picture. You'll see that in Volume 4, in the chapter on the establishment of the kingdom toward the end of the volume. And look forward to that time very much. That would be the establishment of the kingdom. Sometimes pictures have more than one meaning. Now, we know that that's the case with prophecy. Prophecies are susceptible of more than one application. In fact, I remember a radio program I heard years ago by a very gifted Christian speaker. I can't remember his name right now, but if you said that, it would come back to me. But his theme that day was the canon of double sense, because so often prophecies have two meanings. Well, I think types do too sometimes. And I think this is a case, because Paul says that glorious gospel is beaming forth here. But in the bigger respect, I think that's going to have an application to the world of mankind and the kingdom. Now, this isn't the only time you find things like this, where a type or a picture has double meaning. I'll give you another example. You see here on the chart, we have the tabernacle. And you know that holy represents our spirit-begotten condition. And when you finally pass beyond the veil, you're going to go into the spirit-birth condition. That's our glory. Now, that's so common among the brethren. You know, just to refer to it, I see the head shaking. Yeah, that's the way it is. But you know, Paul has something else to say about that. You know, in Hebrews, the 9th chapter, he says, the Holy Spirit tells us the fact that they never went into the holy, except on or into the most holy, except on that one day of the year. And means that while the tabernacle had a standing, that is, during the Jewish age, the way into the holiest was never known and understood during that time. Now that's a very intriguing lesson, very different than we draw from the tabernacle. Who is right? Are we right? Or is Paul right? Well, they're both right. You can't say Paul's wrong. That would be good. And yet, the view that we have, I think, is so fitting, so good. It's one type, there's different lessons drawn from it. And I think that's the case here as well. We're focusing on the gospel age, but not because it has no other meaning to us. Now, there's one more point before we leave the book of Exodus that I'd like to just make a point of. Oh, excuse me. No, there's two more points. Here's one. Exodus, the 40th chapter, when they actually construct the tabernacle and they set it up, was on an auspicious date. It was the first day of the first month of the second year since the Exodus. What that means is we're at a brand new age. Now, you know the tabernacle represents God's plan of atonement as it would proceed during the age of sacrifice, which is the gospel age. And by comparison, Solomon's temple represents things as they will proceed during the kingdom of Christ. So that distinction is good, and I think here, by the tabernacle being set up on the first day of the first month of a brand new year, we're talking about a new age in God's plan, and that is the beginning of the gospel age. Now, one other point, and that is, this is almost not related, but I just have to express it because it was such a new point that we had not seen until we collectively in San Diego went through this carefully. You see, your left. You see the table of showbread, the way I would have drawn it, if I could draw, which I can't. So that table of showbread just has showbread on it, two stacks of six. And you know that represents our spiritual nourishment for the 12 tribes of spiritual Israel. But the table on the right really shows it more accurately the way it really was. You know there were other things on that table? Now you see some scriptures there, do you? Exodus 37, 16, 25, 29, Numbers 4, 7. Read those in the NIV and you'll get an awakening. I did. It's so different, you wouldn't ever guess. But this is what it says. On that table were plates. That's because you didn't put the bread just on the table. You have guests over from your house. You want to serve them a meal. You have some bread. You put the bread right on the table. Now you put a plate down and you put the bread on the plate. And then on the top of each staff, you had frankincense. You don't put it right on the bread. You put a little dish up there and you put the frankincense in the dish. But now the next two, bowls, sometimes said to be cups, and pitchers. Do you know that there was a pitcher on that table? What did that pitcher contain? What do you suppose? It was milk. It was wine. And when you look and see what Jewish sources say about what was on that table, they all agree. There was a pitcher of wine there. And it says in the NIV, a pitcher of wine for the pouring out of the drink offering. Now that's interesting to me. Because in the Holy there was an altar, but there was a specific command in the Holy. That altar in the Holy, you never, ever pour out a drink offering on that altar. So what is that jug of wine for? Well, what's the bread for? The bread is on display as a picture and a symbol of the spiritual nourishment for the 12 tribes, or for us, the 12 tribes of spiritual Israel. What's the jug of wine for? Well, you know, what if you saw bread and wine, what are you going to make of that? That's what Jesus said. My body and my blood. So when you go into the tabernacle and you turn to your right, what you see is Jesus, the bread and the blood. Now you turn to your left, you see a candlestick. You see the seven branches of the seven stages of the church. It just seems so clean. And you look forward and you see the altar. That's what both Jesus and the church used to render their praise, thanks, and sacrifice and devotion to the Heavenly Father before going through the veil. So it's like not really related to our lesson today, except it was such a fresh thought for us and it seemed a beautiful thought. I wanted to mention it. Going on to Leviticus. The book of Leviticus has seven chapters that start with this book, and we almost never read them or discuss them. That's because they're passed right over when you get to Tabernacle Shadows. But they're vital. Do you remember that on the Day of Atonement, the bullock and the goat for the sin offering? Do you remember what you did with the kidneys and the liver? You burned them on the altar along with the fat. But Leviticus 16 never says that. The only way you know that is by looking in Leviticus chapter 4 that talks about how you do a sin offering, and it says that's what you do with the kidneys and the liver. So you use that meaning, you attach it to Leviticus 16, and that's how we know that. Now, Tabernacle Shadows, it talks about the offering of the kidneys and the liver and the refining organs. It makes a beautiful picture. But it's not in Leviticus 16, it's in the first seven chapters. It's a correct point, but it's in the first seven chapters. What I didn't realize before is that those seven chapters all occur on the same day as Exodus chapter 40, starting with verse 1. The first day of the next new year after the Exodus from Israel, from Egypt. So, these seven chapters, they're lengthy, but it's what God is speaking to Moses out of the tabernacle on that very same day. So once you finish those seven chapters, you're still on the same day. During that time, you learn how to do offerings to God. Now, we're going to go on to the consecration of the priesthood pretty quick here in Leviticus. But you can't do that and do the offerings on the consecration of the priesthood unless you know how to do a burnt offering. Well, what are the regulations? And you have to know how to do a peace offering and a sin offering. So you've got to have those seven chapters there to tell you what's going on. But this is a brand new year, I think, representing a new age in God's plan, the age of sacrifice, and that's why it's positioned here. Now in chapters 8, 9, and 16, that's what you read about in Tabernacle Shadows. Now, the brethren don't study a lot of Leviticus that's not in those three chapters. That's understandable. That's where the vibrant, you know, teaching is. That's where it's in Tabernacle Shadows. And what really excited, I think, Brother Russell, to write Tabernacle Shouters, you know, he wrote it before he even wrote Volume 1, right? The first major piece he wrote. And it was because of chapter 16. He saw in Leviticus 16 that first you make atonement for the priests and then for the people in that sequence. Whoa, my goodness, then that explains that we have two ages of redemption. First, to atone for the priests, and then the people are going to get their blessing in the kingdom. Well, if you saw that, when Brother Russell saw it, about 1880 or 1881, wow, that make an impact. You just become aware of the divine plan, you know, in recent years, and now you see how this really focuses the attention of two ages of redemption. You know, often when I talk to people for the first time, fair booth activity or whatever else, trying to find some way to introduce the truth in a good way, to explain the difference of our view, I say, we believe there is not one, but two ages of redemption. And that is kind of explains it. That's the heart and soul of the divine plan. That's what separates you and our fellowship from everybody else out there. Two ages of redemption. A blessed kingdom to come. Now, chapter 8 is what we start in Tabernacle Shadows. It's consecration of the priesthood. It takes 7 days. And those represent the 7 stages of the gospel age church, in my opinion. And it's widely spread when you discuss that area. And then the Tabernacle Shadows jumps right to Leviticus 16, where you have the priests and the people consecutively being atoned for in two ages of redemption. And then you go back to chapter 9. And that's the big question. What is chapter 9 about? And even in the reprints and question book, you see Brother Russell says, you know, the brethren seem to have a question about chapter 9. That's just not as clear. Immediately, chapter 9 in Leviticus is the very first atonement for the people. Now that atonement for the people is an immediate atonement. You've just set up the tabernacle. You've just consecrated the priesthood. And there's a problem. The people have never, ever been atoned for. So you're going to wait 6 months or so, you know, for the Day of Atonement? No, we got to get this taken care of. It's an immediate Day of Atonement. Its offices, its regulations are a little different. And maybe it's kind of a different picture of the same thing. But I have a suggestion for you. This suggestion is pretty much embraced through our study in our local class, our study group. That really the 9th chapter, which goes on into chapter 10, differs from chapter 16 in this respect. Chapter 16 is primarily involved with the atonement for the world of mankind. Oh yeah, the priests have to be atoned for first. That's like a stepping stone to get to the atonement for the world. In chapter 9, I suggest this is primarily an atonement for the gospel age church. Now, I'll just give you 5 or 6 points on this that might be of interest, and time is fleeting, so we're just going to have to kind of itemize these real quick. Chapter 9 is in the spring. Chapter 16 is in the autumn. The spring festivals are about the church. The autumn festivals are about the world of mankind. It's kind of a rule of thumb. You remember the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Gospel age. 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles? Millennial age. You remember the 50th day? Pentecost? Gospel age. The 50th year, Jubilee, that's in the autumn. That's for the world of mankind. So, spring, autumn. Secondly, you know, you might wonder about this. Check me out. If I'm wrong, let me know. Pretty sure. Checked it pretty careful. On this day, on the 9th day, there was no separate atonement for the sons of Aaron as a separate priest class. Unlike in Leviticus 16. Aaron is always cleansed, so the Tabernacle Shadow says he'll be a good picture of Jesus who was sinless. But after that, you've got an atonement for the people. And I will suggest if you compare Hebrews 2:17, Paul says the people in this case represent the gospel age people that are atoned for. Thirdly, there are peace offerings in chapter 9. Peace offerings represent consecration and commitment to God. By contrast, there's no peace offerings in chapter 16. Now, the world of mankind will be committed to God, and sometimes there are peace offerings that are expressed for the world. But if you want to contrast the two ages, you put peace offerings and consecration in the gospel age rather than in the millennial age. And that's what you have here in the 9th chapter. Our time is fleeting. We've got a lot more to say. But I'll add this. At the end of the ninth chapter, you have Aaron, when he's finished offering, he's finished all the sacrifices, he raises his hands and he blesses the people. Then he goes into the tabernacle, and he comes back out, and he blesses them again. Do you know that when Jesus finished his offering for sin, that he, before he left, you find this in Luke 24:50, he raised his hands and he blessed the disciples. And then he went into the tabernacle. That is the spiritual tabernacle of glory. And then Acts 3:26 says, God has sent him back again to bless every one of you in turning away from your sins. So I think in the ninth chapter, this is the point that's involved. Okay, we've got to go on. Between chapter 9 and chapter 16, what do you have? Well, chapter 10 is part of chapter 9. The same narrative. 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. What do you have? You have a lot of things that pertain to both ages of redemption. I'll give you an example. Chapter 11, you have the distinction between clean and unclean animals. Where do you find that distinction in the New Testament relevant? Do you remember when Peter was thinking about things and he hungered and he fell asleep on the rooftop? And then you have that vision of the unclean animals. Lord, he says, what I call unclean, don't you call unclean. You see, that's all about the opening of the gospel to the Gentiles. But won't that also be applicable during the kingdom? Now, we could go through each one of those chapters and show you how each one of those chapters pertains to things that apply to both ages of redemption. Because chapter 9 is focused on the church, chapter 16 on the world, and everything in between applies both ways. Now, I'd love to take, you know, another half hour on this. I just can't. I really love to. But we'll just go on. That pertains to two ages. We'll go on to the book of Numbers. Numbers, by the way, is called in the Hebrew Bible, in the wilderness. That's it. That's what they call the book of Numbers. So now we're getting to the heart and soul of the in the wilderness. And this will be 39 years of duration of their experience in the wilderness. So what do we see? Numbers, the first chapter. And Numbers 1:1 starts with, on the second month, but the first day of the month, that's when, of the second year, that's when you begin. That's why I say that Leviticus is only 1 month in duration. But you say, wait a minute, Leviticus 16 is the seventh month of the year, and that's about the Atonement Day. Well, yeah, but you know that if you read Leviticus, you never get to the Day of Atonement. You never get there. What you see in Leviticus 16 are rules for what you're going to do when you do get there. But you never get there. And now you get to the book of Numbers, you're just to month number 2. That's all. So we got 1 month in Leviticus, now we're on to Numbers. Census record. That's why we call it Numbers, because there's a lot of numbers here. You have the census of all the adult Israelites. This census really took place weeks or months earlier, but now on this day it's recorded. Not going to make any point here, but just recognize that's a time frame. And chapter 2, it tells you how the Israelites are going to be distributed around the tabernacle. Chapter 3, we zoom in on the Levites. They're going to be distributed around the tabernacle closer than the others. And the Levites are exchanged for the firstborn. Well, who are the firstborn? You remember what Paul talks about? The church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. That's you. I hope I'm on that register. I hope when I spend my years, I'll still be on the register. I hope. Those are the ones that are called, the spirit-begotten ones called to the heavenly calling. I think that tells us that the Levites are now going to be the spiritually minded and spiritually begotten new creatures. The Levite duties are in chapter 4. And now we're going to go on to the assignment of the Levites in their camps around the tabernacle. Now there you see them, Gershon on the west, and we have Kohath on the south, we have Merari on the north, and we have Moses and Aaron and their families on the east. Now we have those labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, because that's the sequence in which they're given in Numbers chapter 3. There's a meaning to that. Gershon was the firstborn, Kohath next, Merari next, and then Aaron and Moses came after that. Now there is a picture here. And I'm almost afraid to go on to it. I'm going to have to. It's the next slide. But I just want to make this point. By comparison, in the wilderness, the Levites are the consecrated, just like the firstborn, and the Israelites, we're going to talk about in a moment, they're the believers in the Christian world. Well, where are the unbelievers? Back in Egypt. They're back in Egypt. Now, you remember back in Egypt, on Nisan the 14th, which is really Abib the 14th, you know, back in those days. You remember in the house at night, when they're observing Passover, you remember who's in the house? There's the firstborn and the Israelites. Only the firstborn is subject to jeopardy. Only the consecrated could lose their spiritual life. But there's a lot of others that are believers in Jesus and appreciate what He has done for them. Those are the consecrated, firstborn, and the believers. Outside, those are the Egyptians, those are the unbelievers. You come into the wilderness, it's the same picture, except the Levites have been exchanged for the firstborn. Now, I want to make this point, because it might be a little subtle concern. The Levites are never distinguished from the priests, ever, in Leviticus. The Levites are distinguished from the priests one time in the book of Numbers, and we'll get to that in a moment. And that's where the Levites and the priests separate into two different groups. But before that, all you've got is the Levites and the camp of Israel. And I believe that is the consecrated and the Christian believers ready to make their way in the Christian world. Now I'm going to skip the next slide. I'll get back to it. Real quick, get back. Go over there. Then in chapter 2, it tells you how the Israelites are camped outside in their groups, and there's a meaning to those four groups as well. We have to bypass it. But in some sense or other, the leader of each of those groups is somehow related as a leader. We'll just leave it there. So what you've got is the consecrated and the Christian world. Now, why are there four? Well, because there's 4 points to the compass. And you remember in the book of Zechariah, God said to Israel, I have spread you abroad to the four corners of the earth. So I think to represent all of those that are consecrated and all of those that are believers, they're in the four corners, as it were, of the spiritual earth. Now we'll get back to that missing slide. Now this is something that you'll find in volume 6, page 128, and it extends the picture of these four parts of the Levites beyond the gospel age to its full completion in the big picture. And I think that picture is good. I like it very much. You'll find that we have on the south the ancient worthies, on the north the great company, the world of mankind in the west, and the church class on the east. Can't talk much about it. Time's running short. But I think that that's good. But remember those four classes as we go on to the next one. First of all, you've got the spirit begotten, and you've got the believers ready for their journey through the gospel age, their 40-year trek. Okay, only 39 years have left, but I mean for the bulk of it. You're ready to go. But now, what's the point of this journey? The point is to be faithful. It's a test of fidelity for me and for all of us who have a heavenly hope. And chapter 5 is all about the test of fidelity. A husband suspects his wife of infidelity. How do you know? How do you determine? This is what you do. You take some water, and you go into the tabernacle in the holy, and you take some of the dust from the tabernacle floor, and you mix it into the water, and then the woman drinks this, and you see what the results. If it passes through her without effect, she's clean, she's okay, she's been faithful. But if not, that's a testimony of her infidelity. And that's a testimony for us. All of us are in the holy. And there's dust in the holy. It's not like Solomon's temple where it's, you know, paved with gold. There's contamination down there. We're all going to have our feet in contact with contaminating things in this earth. This is going to happen. But if we're faithful, when that contamination is mixed with the water of truth, it'll go through of us without harm. But if we're not faithful, there will be consequences. We may lose our spiritual life. Remember Jesus said, what you all need is feet cleaning. And Peter says, no, I would never take this. If I don't clean your feet, you've got no part with me. He said, well then, do it all. And he says, no, thank you, Peter. All you need is your feet clean. You're already clean, you just need a little feet washing. That's what we need. We need our feet washed from the defilements that we get. But we have been justified. We have been cleansed. Okay, now in chapter 6, what do you get? You have the vow of the Nazarite, and what is that all about but the church class? Just, I'll leave it right at that. Chapter 7, you have the princes step forward in making commitments of every tribe to the worship of the tabernacle. So, what are the princes in all the earth? There's the ancient worthies. So, chapter 8, you have the Levites distinguished from the priests for the first time. The Levites wash their robes and are given to the priest as a helper. That's the great company who wash their robes and then are given to the church in the kingdom. In chapter 9, we have the Passover. And the problem comes up in chapter 9. It says, we have some Israelites who are unclean or were away on a journey when they should have kept the Passover. What do we do? He says, well, then you keep it the next full moon. And that's the world of mankind. They're going to keep it the next full moon. Now, you remember those four camps of Levites in the big ending picture? You had the church, the ancient worthies, the ring company, and the world of mankind. This is what makes me think that volume 6, page 128, has the right idea about the Levites camped around the tabernacle. Because sometimes scripture does that. They give you a picture, these four, and then they'll give you another picture of the same thing. You think, I think we got it. I think we're on the right track. But there's more. And William's very patient. He said, this is the last talk of the night. So he said, maybe it's okay. So just be patient. So just a little bit more. We can't talk about this. There's the next series of chapters in Numbers. You know what that is? That's seven episodes that take you through the gospel age in seven stages of the church. From the preparation of two silver trumpets, the Old and New Testament, to the murmuring of the tares, to the challenge of leadership in the church of Pergamos, to the fourth church of Thyatira, things are really bad. And they just refused their inheritance, and many of them spiritually died. To the period of the Reformation when Martin Luther saw them selling indulgences for money, not the real wood of the cross, but just these sticks, these imitations. And then the great earthquake that swallowed up Cora's Rebellion, there's the French Revolution. And finally, the budding forth of the almond rod, and that it represents the budding forth of the church in glory in the seventh stage of the church. We pass that by. That's gospel age. What do you get to after that? Chapter 18, the priests are established and ready to go. Chapter 19, the red heifer. What do you think the red heifer is? I think maybe that's on the right track. So there you go. There's the next class steps forward. And after that, now this is going to be, not as crisp. But Aaron finishes his course. Aaron, I think, here is the high priest, represents our Lord Jesus as our high priest in the gospel age. There's going to come a time when that service is finished and complete. And that time comes when the last spirit-begotten member goes beyond the veil. I don't mean the last member of the church. I mean the last spirit-begotten member. Who will that be? Great company. So you've got the great company class. And then finally, you've got that copper serpent that's healing the whole world of mankind. You have the world of mankind. That's exactly the same four classes in the big picture. Okay, we're going to stop, we're going to summarize, and we're going to conclude. We've looked at in the wilderness experiences of three books. We found that all of them have heavy focus on the gospel age when you and I are wandering through the wilderness ready to receive the glorious reward of the saints beyond the veil. We find in this the test of fidelity we have to pass through. All of the experiences of the Israelites recorded in which sometimes they murmured, they complained, sometimes they overcame. And we realize the gospel age is a period of jeopardy. We have to pass those tests and prove faithful. And finally, we're going to see in the divine plan, all of the groups of faith develop to their fullness. Whether it be the world, the mankind, the great company, the ancient worthies, or as we hope to be, part of God's spiritual life. Well, let us be faithful as much as we're able. Let us put aside the weight of sin and seek to be thankful that Christ has borne that burden and that we now have the responsibility not to worry about that sin, but to just day by day seek to do what we're able to be faithful.